Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. In this second episode of General Talk, we turn the focus on the complex and exacting operations of ABF itself. My guest to discuss the daily workings of the Army's national charity, eschewed the chance to study rock formations at university for the Royal Corps of Transport, and the tortuous operating tables and formulae of convoy and logistics management that kept three armour divisions in the field in the late 1970s, when the British Army of the Rhine sat out the Cold War on the plains of the then Western Germany. Preparation, indeed, for the position he's held at the very heart of the Soldiers' Charity as its Chief of Staff and Chief Operating Officer since leaving the Army in 2010. Brigadier Robin Bacon, welcome to the podcast. So I think the best place for us to start is at the beginning. And why did you join the British Army?
Okay, I joined the Army in 1978. I'd had a little short spell at university, which wasn't altogether successful. I'd dreamed of being a geologist, you know, chipping away, finding gold in the Rockies and so on. And I realised that it actually wasn't quite like that. It was going to be terribly tedious, you know, working on the North Sea and so on. So this chap I met said, why don't you join the Army? You know, it was like I'd done the Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme. I was a Queen's Scout and so forth. And I thought, actually, this could be quite fun. So I joined on a short service commission in 1978. And the rest is history. I did 32 years after that.
You were in the Royal Corps of Transport. You served throughout the height of the Cold War, you could argue. You watched the Army gradually reduce down. How did you find it at the beginning and the end?
Well, at the beginning, Harry, you know, you go out on exercise in Germany, and we knew there were three divisions in Germany alone, and you join this convoy on the Autobahn heading east out to the River Weser, and you just see, by goodness, we have a huge army. And I think there were over 200,000 people in the army at that point in time. And then later in my career, when I was at this great title, Colonel Manning Army, sounds like Colonel Mannering or Captain Mannering. When I was Colonel Manning, we had 110,000. Even that seemed, we were chuntering and muttering, and oh, this is terrible, this is far too small, 110,000. Then now you look now at what the actual train strength is, it's almost beyond belief as to what we can and can't do. And we were struggling with 110,000 as to whether it's possible to do another Gulf, all those sort of large-scale activities. But it's quite incredible how it's come down over time.
Well, you're now Chief of Staff and Chief Operating Officer of ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. The problem outside the Army, that the veterans and their immediate family, is greater, if not greater yet, than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago.
I think there's a misconception about veterans, that they're older people, you know, the chaps you see in their blazers, you know, at Remembrance Day and with the collecting tins for the Legion and so on. Actually, it's the youngsters. I mean, we support an awful lot of 30, 40-year-olds, and people don't realise, actually, these are people who, you know, they can be in need, in dire need. And it's not want that we support, it is very much that need. And the charity's been around, as you know, for 76 years, been doing very much the same thing. So I was with the charity when we relabeled in 2010, or became ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, as opposed to the Army Benevolent Fund. Remember the Duke of Edinburgh questioned me on it and said, why? And I said, the difficulty is people didn't understand the term benevolence. And there was a little mutter about whether or not people were well enough educated to realise. But anyway, what we are is what it says on the tin, the Soldiers' Charity. And you know, it's surprising how many young soldiers who've only served a matter of years, not decades, you know, who then fall on hard times later in life, and there's that intervention. The other thing I want to say about the charity, it's compared with other service charities, and as you know, there are a lot of service charities, but we're one of the larger ones. The point is that we don't operate in a completely sort of binary way. So you could be a veteran who's in difficulty, and the system could say to you, okay, well, look, how much have you got in the bank? Do you pay a mortgage, do you pay rent, whatever it is, or do you have anything, possessions at all? You have some salary. No, we won't give you anything. No, you're out of it. Whereas the grant giving to individuals in this charity is much, much more sensitive and much less binary in terms of yes, this person has absolute genuine need. We can make a difference at this critical point in someone's life. And I think that's the overarching thing I found over 10 years in the charity. Is the thing I'm most proud of the charity doing is being able to make that intervention at key times. And we have these wonderful ambassadors. They have been beneficiaries in the past. And some of them, one of them, Andy Reid, who you probably met or seen on our website, triple amputee, he's a very much a sort of mind over matter person. His great maxim is the body will achieve what the mind believes. And he does that with one arm, you know, and gets on a hand cycle and does all sorts of things. But he was helped once or twice, you know, quite significantly when he was first there in Headley Court 11 years ago. But he's repaid that massively by coming and speaking about the charity and explaining how the charity helped him and his then partner, now wife, at an absolutely critical time in life, without asking too many questions, without fuss, just getting on with it and sorting things out. And that's really, I think that's our USP for the charity.
Do you think that that the field, as it were, is muddied by the fact there are so many military charities in the field, as it were, now?
There are an awful lot of military charities, as you say, Harry. There are over 1,800 of them, and I know the papers often make hay about this. But the reality is actually there's only just over 40 charities who have incomes over £5 million. So there's an awful lot who have minuscule income and rely on all sorts of things. We don't rely on any government funding whatsoever, and that helps hugely, because it's when you get that taken away, whether it's grants and aid, what it might be, then that's when a charity becomes very vulnerable. I mean, I'm associated with a health charity which has relied on government funding, and it's just come to a grinding halt. You know, there isn't any government funding. So of those 40-odd charities, I mean, they work very closely together. There's an enormous collaboration between the service charities, which may not be apparent to people outside, but in terms of casework, you know, very joined up. I talk regularly with my opposite numbers in the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy. You know, we share best practice and we do all sorts of things, you know, together, although we keep our unique identities.
As a key funder, what are the sources of income for the charity? Because in terms of events at the moment, things must be quite hampered, I imagine.
Yes, they are. I mean, events are but one stream. I mean, the core things you need in running a charity and fundraising is you need a really clever team who can do trusts, partnerships, philanthropy, tap into the goodwill of certain sort of organisations. The corporates, of course, are in no position to give much money or whatever at the moment. But actually, within the corporates, what we find is if we can lay on an event, and we'll talk about events in just a minute, where they take part, then very often that corporate body will match fund whatever people raise. So, for instance, we had 40 people from Oracle every year doing the Catherine Yomp, which is our 54-mile flagship event in Scotland. They all raise thousands of pounds. Oracle matches what they raise. And that's our way of getting fundraising.
We're saying that all these events are very participatory.
That's why in the regions, things like the Salisbury Cathedral concerts and so on were very, very popular.
But the spiciest, tastiest fundraiser ever, I think, is discussed as the curry lunch.
I mean, we have the Lord Mayor's Big Curry every year, and this year it had to we had to cancel it. And that's always in April in the Guildhall. And that's an amazing event. There's well over 1,000 people come to it. It raises a huge amount of money. People are very, very generous with their sponsorship and with buying tickets and buying raffle prizes and so on. But what is interesting is curry as a theme for the Soldiers Charity has always had resonance, because we've been having curries forever, you know, for centuries, ever since we had an army in India and elsewhere in the world. Out in the counties, the county committees, and you can remember there's 60-odd county committees we have, they love a curry lunch. You know, when you joined the army and went to a curry lunch, these are the same things. People were very nostalgic. Now, clearly, events have had a real hit this year. I mean, we've lost hundreds of events, and clearly we've lost quite a lot of fundraising income. But where we've been prescient is starting virtual events last year. You know, a year before this coronavirus pandemic, we were doing these virtual events. Op Bletchley, which we've just had for the second time this summer, I'd had thousands of people taking part in it, and they raised, you know, £130,000, £140,000. of which actually the net is tremendous. Whereas if you have a big event up in Scotland with mountain rescue and so on, I know you've tramped around the country, so you'll appreciate these things, but you can't just cast people adrift in the Cairngorms. You know, you need all the sort of checkpoints and places to get the ice cream and blister relief and that sort of thing. And so actually the net is not quite so good. But the other thing is we built up this fantastic following of followers who take part in events. And so, for instance, the Catherine Yomp is its 10th year. The Frontline Walk, which started in 2014 and we thought would finish in 2018, has this hundreds of people who absolutely love it and really wedded to it. And they do it year after year after year, and they support others. And so there's a big online community in doing these things. So I'm very confident that the events will come back, distance, you know, where they can. And you can't be much more distance than spread out over the Cairngorms, you know, in terms of fresh air and so forth. But overall, it is tough times. It's very tough times, but it just relies on having trusts in both sense of the word. You know, the big trusts have money which they'll give to charities who can prove that they've got good governance, which we believe we have, which can spend money wisely. We have follow-ups. We don't give money to third party without really digging into that third party to make sure they're delivering on our behalf properly. So these trusts need to trust us, the trusts and foundations, and that's very big. I mean, we always have been a very trusted charity. Yeah, that's a good cause. ABF, that's good. And that's key. And if you lose that, then we'd lose out massively. People believe in us.
I'd like to bring it down perhaps a bit to the grassroots level. Simplistically, every Monday night in our car park in the pub down here in Dorset, we have a fish and chip van, and he has an ABF donation tin. Is there some sort of means in which ABF can have some form of sort of national flag day, as it were?
Well, we've talked about this, we prefer to keep sort of low profile and not being flash. Being flash costs money. I mean, the Legion are fortunate in that they can have their collections, the license to have those collections. The railways will let them put their posters up on the trains and so on. They don't charge them for it. And if you start doing a fundraising campaign, you can spend a serious amount of money on it. Mm-hmm. And it's finding a balance for us as being a quietly getting on with it charity, or being a little bit more flash, but spending a lot of marketing money, which we don't want to do. We like PR, you know, we like good PR, of course, not negative PR, and we avoid that wherever we can. But the thing about the collecting is that we rely hugely on the goodwill of the public, of course, in wanting to give money. But it is a case of having a spread across the country. So there you are in Dorset, and there's a committee in Dorset, as there's a committee in Devon and Cornwall and so on, and they'll organise things. So hundreds of these events, some of them quite small, but all absolutely wonderful. I mean, I went a few years ago to a curry lunch on the Isle of Wight, and it was in the Royal Yacht Squadron. I mean, what a fantastic place to go and have curry, looking out over the water in front of you. Just fantastic. Supporters, then, they feel the love, they feel they belong, and so on. So, an interesting, whilst the ability to give money is generally something that older people have rather than younger people. If I compare myself with my sons, who are, you know, in their 30s, but they'll do take part in events and raise money that way and so on. So you've got to tap into people's sensitivities in different sorts of ways. But it's hard, and it's definitely going to be a tough year and tougher going forward. And I think for a number of the smaller service charities, they haven't got the reserves, because we've been very careful to husband our resources to build reserves so that actually when times are tough like they are now, and they could get, and even if they were to get worse, we know that we can keep on doing what we must do, and that's giving grants to those soldiers, veterans and their families who are in real need right now, without saying, oh, terribly sorry, we can't do that this year, we're running out of money. We can tap into those free reserves to do it.
Let's talk about the times being tough right now. In the last 3 months, the amount of grants that ABF has has given is a spectacular amount of money. Can you enlighten us on that?
Since March, where we moved seamlessly into this remote working, we've disbursed about £3 million to the Army family in need. And so about £1 million of that was to individuals, when I say individuals and their families in need. So that's a real lifeline for them. And then other parts of it is going out to other charities who rely on grants from us to deliver those services to servicemen. Now, it might be that, if we're supporting a care home in Newcastle, that care home may have 30 soldiers in it. So what we'll do is we'll fund 30 soldiers worth of costs and so on in that care home. But it's that ability to do that. And a number of other charities have had to really slow down on their grant giving. But we're very, very clear that where there's a must, then we will support those third-party organisations who provide that valuable service to the Army community, the Army family.
We've talked from the Cairngorms right down to as far as Devon and the Isle of Wight. However, ABF is active in over 59 different countries, if that's correct.
Harry, the big chunk of those countries overseas come to us through the Royal Commonwealth Ex Services League, who we are their biggest supporter. Now, this is a fantastic organisation, which it puts hot meals on the plates of a King African Rifles veteran who's in his 80s and 90s. So all around the world, in what could be termed the former Commonwealth, places like British Somaliland, people thought, where's that? Well, that's buried in Somalia, but there was this British Somaliland. Myanmar, well, Burma veterans. So I have a personal interest in this because I chair a charity which looks after the former Hong Kong servicemen. And that, do you know, there are 8,500 ex-Hong Kong servicemen still around since 1997, who obviously they were all discharged then when the flag was hauled down on that rainy evening. And they need our support. I mean, they were sailors and soldiers in the same way as anybody else. Okay, they had different terms of service because they were locally enlisted, but they did Purbright courses. I mean, I took my hat off to a Chinese sergeant who can go to Purbright and survive a drill course, or whatever courses it might be. So these guys actually are pretty self-sufficient. So they're very proud and they want to get on. But just occasionally, we need to give a little bit of help and a little tweaking to help these people. So the range is enormous. So you can have your house in Fiji when it's blown away by a hurricane, then actually the cost of repairing it is not the same as repairing a house in Florida or Lucia and so on. So a little bit goes a long way. And actually, when you look at the Commonwealth soldiers we have now and have had now for the last sort of 20 years, I think in your generation and my generation, there were probably 300 Fijians in the whole of the British Army in the 80s. And you'll remember them very, very clearly because they filled the rugby teams and so on. Then they disappeared. And then, of course, the Commonwealth came back in spades when there was a relaxation of rules on number of years in the country and so on. So there's active recruiting went on in places like Fiji. And by goodness, what for incredible sportsmen we then enlisted into the British Army. But when these people go home, I mean, they're enlisted in London, but when they go home, actually they're in trouble, then we have a moral responsibility to help them. So you've got Commonwealth veterans all over the place. I think probably 10,000 or so of the Army any one time is Commonwealth, and certainly Gurkhas. I know Gurkhas have their own charity, but we work very, very closely with the Gurkhas, with the Gurkha Welfare Trust, and we look after the Gurkhas in England almost on their behalf, and they look after Gurkhas in Nepal. It's a bit of a quirk, but you see them, you see the chaps everywhere.
As president of the Hong Kong Ex-Servicemen's Association, with the difficulties, the political difficulties that Hong Kong is experiencing right now, that must have added to your workload, has it?
It has. We need to be incredibly careful in terms of what we say and what we do. You know, the reality is for the older Hong Kong veteran, you've got to remember the average age of the Hong Kong veteran is mid-60s now, they would prefer it to be peace and quiet because actually they rely on the marginal economy for jobs. There is a lot of ageism in the workplace in Hong Kong. And before all the riots kicked off, they were able to get jobs, you know, part-time driving, whatever they might do, and they were happy. When the rioting started, the demonstrations started, which for all sorts of reasons, and we certainly remain apolitical and sort of don't comment on anything like that, because we rely on the goodwill of keeping a good relationship with the Hong Kong government, for better or for worse, whatever people think of it, to be able to collect. We work jointly with the Legion in Hong Kong, and we are able to collect on Remembrance Day. They could very easily close that down, the government, if they thought that we were being subversive or saying sort of the wrong things. Whereas actually, we want to look after the 8,500. And you know, people in their 60s, they get strokes, they get heart attacks, they get illnesses and so on. And these people need looking after. So we have to be incredibly careful. A number came to UK in 97 on passports. There is this whole thing about British national overseas passports and so on as well. But actually, the vast majority who came over, the majority prefer to live in Hong Kong. And those who did come over to UK in 1997, a number of them have gone back because actually they prefer it. They've got their mates, their families, and it actually wasn't such a bad place after all. But for the younger generations, you know, the younger generation who were born post 97, then there's troubled times ahead. But so for the service charity, for looking after the Hong Kong veterans, we just need to play it very, very carefully, you know, especially what we put on the internet, a message and so on, because you never know who's watching or listening to, you know, to what's being said. But overall, they're happy. Happy as can be, should I say, despite the restrictions.
ABF is well supported by the royal family, and I know that the Prince of Wales often attends the city curry lunch with the Lord Mayor's big curry, but we have a new patron on board now. Would you like to tell us a bit about the new royal arrival, as it were?
We are enormously, enormously privileged that Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall graciously accepted our offer to become vice patron. Her Majesty the Queen has been our patron for decades, you know, since Her Majesty's accession. And Her Majesty has been a wonderful patron, very kind in responding to messages of support and so on. But with the number of events that we have and just trying to take it a little bit sort of, we felt that the Duchess of Cornwall had a fantastic fit with the charity. But remember, her father, he won the MC twice in the Second World War, so she has an affinity for the army, and she's very graciously accepted our invitation. So post-COVID, we very much hope to be able to see Her Royal Highness on a few more occasions.
As Chief of Staff, as Chief Operating Officer of ABF, you are the man who can, you're the man who makes it happen, you're that careful pair of hands that says, when the Chief Executive turns up, or the President turns up, says, everything in order, Robin? And you say, yes, sir, all in order. Do you find that that having retired from the army, when you perhaps hoped that things would be a little easier, you've rather jumped out of the frying pan into the fire?
Yeah, when I first started in 2010, we'd just gone through this reorganisation. And to be honest, the charity in 2010 was, I'm not being unkind, but it was there were quite a few sleepy practices, I think. It was terribly nice, and there were all sorts of practice and precedent that had gone on for a long time, but it really needed a bit of a wake-up call, and combination of myself coming in and saying, well, look, what have we got in terms of how is the thing governed, and how do we manage X, Y, and Z? Have we got a policy for this? Not to go to policy mad, but just to make sure that we could hold our head up high and know that people could then tell we're an efficient business, not spendthrift, wasting money on things and so on. So a new generation of staff so then came in, and obviously Martin Rutledge, who you know, came in as chief exec a couple of years after I did, and we overhauled a lot of the business processes with reasonably light touch. I mean, we haven't got the resource to run, you know, a divisional headquarters with these things. So we have to do everything in with the right sort of sense and sensibility. But, you know, the most precious thing we have is not our reserves. I mean, there's obviously money is money. But our most precious thing, actually, is the hundreds of thousands of supporters we have in our database. So so things like responsibility for our data, working what we need to with the Information Commissioner's Office to comply with general data protection regulations and data protection and so on. There's a whole industry out there, and we have to try and manage it in the best possible way. So we have to be very strict and have to ride people hard on it. But, you know, we don't want you to compromise your personal information because you've made a donation for something. So, and that's where reputation is can be lost. So it wasn't, I didn't expect it to be easy, but interesting, I wasn't sure how challenging it would be. I was told by one of the trustees, oh, in 2 or 3 years, you'll have it all sorted and then you'll be bored. But it's never been that way. It's been fantastic. It's been a real roller coaster for 10 years and there's more to be done. Yeah, absolutely. It's a really busy role.
I know you have all sorts of wonderful qualifications, MBAs and diplomas in human relations, etc., etc. But outside of all this, you're also something of a musician, I gather.
I love music. I was a music scholar at school, playing the cello. And after I joined the army, of course, I didn't play very much, but occasional concert with the orchestra at a mess night or something, with a little solo, and so that was fun. But what was really tremendous was last year is we had a competition for the Soldiers' Charity to have its own march, regimental march. And because of all the coronavirus, we haven't been able to sort of take it further forward, but we had the judging, and I shared the judging panel with two other very extremely, you know, the most senior directors of music for the army and myself, and who were, of course, technically, they were miles and miles ahead of me. I was just sort of a grade 8 musician from at the age of 18. But we've chosen a most fantastic march, and hopefully it will be played on Horse Guards next year.
Of course, we talk about now about music, and it is very hard nowadays to see military musicians playing in the public eye because it's so expensive and because there's so many rules and hoops we have to jump through. One of the great events that you were all involved with was, of course, the British Military Tournament, which ran between 2010 and 2013. You must have enjoyed that, did you?
I absolutely loved the British Military Tournament. It went, as you say, for 4 years. We had such a special time. The soldiers and sailors and airmen, in fact, and Marines, you know, who took part in it, they absolutely loved it. The whole spirit around it. It took an awful lot of organising. I was the chairman after even Webb Carter stopped. You know, he launched it, and I then took it over. And pulling together the strings to get Earl's Court filled up, you know, for 4 performances or 5 performances was quite something. But the most special thing for me as chairman was the dress rehearsal on the Friday night. Everyone would be in there completely in the right uniforms. And because we had obviously royals coming to nearly every performance, and especially if it was Her Majesty, then as you know better than I do, you know, the lifeguards had to be in the proper kit, the proper dress, you know, frock coats. And they would dress for the dress rehearsal, and we had this whole thing with the finale. And I would then sort of take the salute. And I can't tell you how exciting that is for a loggie to take a salute from, you know, with 600 people, in just so splendid, you know, the entire mass bands of the Household Division and so on, and being the person in the spotlight at Earl's Court, it was a real thrill. Sadly missed, but then Earl's Court was knocked down a year later, and, you know, it's now a building site.
Do you think that a similar event, perhaps on a more reduced scale, will appear again in the years to come, in that nowadays organizations such as ABF, the RAF Benevolent Fund, the Royal Navy, Royal Marines Charity, they are now the sort of the interface in many ways between the armed forces and the public?
I would love to see that happen. I think the resource issue, and you need a lot of sponsorship, and we were very fortunate with sponsorship. I mean, headline sponsor was Boeing and a number of others. I mean, it is an expensive thing to put on, but the cooperation of the services in taking part, it was quite fantastic. What a wonderful relationship with London District, and that they gave us so many resources. But it's the venue, Harry, is the issue. I mean, you can imagine that when you're coming off at high speed out of Earl's Court 1 into Earl's Court 2, as it's called, and you've got a gun carriage behind you, you need about a 100-meter deceleration lane to get out. So, you know, having these things out in the open air is all very well, but then you're very, very risk of English weather. So, as indeed the Edinburgh to 2 finds with its slipping on the cobbles in the wet weather. So, I think it'd be an amazing thing to do again. There would certainly be an appetite for. There's a huge following from Brisbane Tourism on social media who would love to see it back again, but I don't know who's going to do it and who's going to put the money and the time into it.
I think it is fair to say that if it is redone again, it won't be under your guidance, because you very sadly are shortly due to retire from ABF.
Now, I've done 10 and a half years. I think it's time for someone new to come in. When I arrived, I was very, very up with exactly how to tweak the Treasury and the Office of National Statistics and all these sort of ONS, all these sort of people. And I was able to do a lot of quite serious governance work, you know, getting the charity incorporated and so on. But I don't have those contacts now in the Treasury and so on, which I did have when I came out of the MOD to do so. So I think it needs someone new to come and do new things. I've got an awful lot on. I love being running the Hong Kong Trust. I'm also chair of governance for my old school in Gloucestershire. And I work with a number of health charities as a trustee. And there's just never enough time for these things. I mean, this role in Solus Charity is a serious, you know, full-time grown-up role. There's no part-time in this. I'd love to have just a bit more time for travel, which we're time poor working full-time like this.
And time. Ever at a premium meant that we too had to draw our discussions to a close. But my thanks to Brady Robin Bacon, not only for such a frank and broad overview of ABF, its diverse operations and the challenges it faces today, but also for the last 10 years he has devoted to safeguard the institution, no doubt for many years to come. If you'd like to learn more about the work of the Soldiers Charity or take part in its many events, whether virtual or real, please visit thesoldierscharity.org. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity. Ta-da!